Hello, welcome along. I'm Justin Briley, your host for Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon as part of Faith Explored. And Unbelievable is the programme that brings together Christians and non-Christians for dialogue and debate, a space in the week here on Premier when we can listen to opposing points of view. And today, it's a classic atheist versus Christian debate, and two very eminent guests join me. William Lane Craig is a noted Christian philosopher, and Daniel Kame is an atheist philosopher. They're going to be talking about a rather unusual argument for the existence of God. More on that in just a moment's time. Don't forget that later on in the show, we'll hear some of your feedback. Last week's show, very popular indeed online, and we'll be hearing some of your feedback to that on the nature of hell between Dr. Al Mohler and Chris Date. We're also going to be hearing later on today on Premier the profile interview. That's between 4 and 5 as part of Faith Explored. I'll be speaking to Pete Gregg, the founder of the 24/7 prayer movement. There's lots of other good reasons to keep listening this Saturday afternoon, and you can find out more on the schedule from Premier Christian Radio. And if you want to find out about programmes from Unbelievable and the vast back catalogue of shows and the ways to listen via iTunes and more about our resources, just go to the website of the show, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Right now, let's get into today's discussion. You're unbelievable. Well, today on Unbelievable, we're asking, does the uncanny effectiveness of mathematics provide evidence for God? Two fabulous guests join me on the programme today. Dr. William Lane Craig, known to many as simply Bill, is a noted Christian philosopher and heads up the apologetics ministry Reasonable Faith. And our other guest is Dr. Daniel Kame, philosophy lecturer at the University of Hull. He's a sceptical agnostic, but has been appreciative of Bill's contributions to the philosophy of religion over the last few years. They both join me today on the programme to talk about this interesting issue of the issue of mathematics and God. A very warm welcome to you both, gentlemen.
Thank you, Justin.
Great to have you here. Let's come to you first of all, Bill. We obviously saw you over in the UK back in July when you joined me for the Unbelievable conference. But you've been working on some fairly interesting stuff, haven't you? Do you want to just give us an idea of what you've been burrowing into in the last year or so?
Sure. I have been reading extensively for several years now in the philosophy of mathematics with a view toward understanding the existence of mathematical objects like numbers and sets and functions and other abstract objects, and asking how these relate to God. Are they created by God? Are they ideas in the mind of God? Or do they simply not exist at all? Do they exist independently of God? So that's been the question that I've been exploring. And in the course of this study, this question that you raised today kept coming up, namely the applicability of mathematics to the physical world. And this is one of the most famous problems in the philosophy of mathematics, what the physicist Eugene Wigner called the uncanny effectiveness of mathematics, the ability to describe the physical world through mathematics. And this is a puzzle because whether these mathematical objects like numbers and functions and so forth are abstract entities that exist beyond time and space and are causally impotent, or whether you think of them as just useful fictions, it's very difficult to understand the relationship between these and math and physical reality, and why physical reality should be so describable.
It is an extraordinary thing, and as you say, obviously your studies have kind of brought this question up again and again. I've noticed, in fact, before we get to kind of really nailing down what this argument is as it relates to the existence of God, you've been using it more, for instance, in public debates, in presentations on the existence of God.
Yes, it sort of thrust itself upon me. As I say, this wasn't a question that I initially intended to explore, but as I looked at the views of both realists and anti-realists about mathematical objects, it was very evident to me that neither of these camps was able to provide any sort of an explanation of mathematics' applicability to the physical world. And this was self-confessed. They were self-confessedly at a loss to explain why mathematics is applicable to the physical world, whether you're a realist or an anti-realist. And it occurred to me that theism enjoyed a considerable advantage in this respect, that the theist has explanatory resources that are not available to the naturalist, whether he be a realist or an anti-realist. And so that's how I came upon this argument and began to float it in debates and public lectures to see how people might respond.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to our discussion here today.
Sure. Well, we'll get to kind of nailing down on some of those terms you're using there, realist and anti-realist, and how that links into the discussion today. But it's great to have you back on the program today, Bill.
Thank you.
And if you want to find out more about Bill, reasonablefaith.org is where you can find loads of his writing and feedback, podcast, and more. Also a great pleasure to welcome onto the program today Dr. Daniel Kame. Hello, Daniel.
Hi, Justin.
It's great to have you on. Daniel, we first of all kind of got to know each other at least a little back in 2011 when Bill came over to the UK for a tour. And it was interesting at that time, even as a sceptical agnostic / atheist, you were quite supportive, actually, of what Bill was aiming to do in opening up these questions around God and so on. So you're obviously evidently very open to this kind of dialogue and discussion.
Yeah, I am. I mean, I would describe myself, I suppose, as a sceptical agnostic, as you said in your introduction, but I kind of oscillate between varying degrees of scepticism, I suppose. But it was worrying about the question of the existence of God that really got me interested in philosophy as a teenager, and I still regard it as a question of vital importance. But yes, my own position is one of agnosticism, although having said that, I think that some of the traditional arguments for the existence of God, in particular the argument from the fine-tuning of the universe, deserve to be taken more seriously than they are by a lot of academic philosophers. And I also think that it can be very difficult to live with the what you might call the existential implications of an atheistic worldview, and that if one actually tries to live with the consequences of atheism, that this can be kind of existentially very difficult. And so, in a certain sense, in order to be a functional, life-affirming, self-affirming agent, one must, in the end, have recourse to various kinds of illusions. And I suppose that these might form the basis for a pragmatic argument, not an argument for the existence of God, but an argument for the rationality of belief in God, even if there's no or insufficient evidence that he exists. So yeah, I'm a skeptic, but I'm sympathetic to the conclusions of theism and to the religious sensibility, as it were. That is, to seeing the world in religious terms.
Mm.
Do so.
In that sense, you sound like you're an atheist who isn't exactly an evangelistic one, in the sense of believing atheism really is the best story out there.
No, I mean, I certainly try to remain open-minded about the possibility that I might be completely wrong in my skepticism. And I certainly don't claim to know that atheism is true, and I remain open to the possibility that some form of theism, or perhaps more likely deism, deism being the view that God created the universe but then kind of left it to his own devices, open to the possibility that might be true. For all I know, the universe was indeed created by some kind of divine intelligence, or may even itself be some form of divine intelligence. I'm skeptical, but I try to remain open-minded.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's great to have you on the program today. If people want to find out more about you, I know you have a sort of faculty page at the University of Hull's website as well. And it'd be interesting to really to get your responses to this particular issue of the applicability of mathematics and whether that provides evidence for God. If you're interested in getting in touch yourself listening today and you'd like your thoughts spelt out on the program, why not send me an email and I'll do my best to read as many of those in forthcoming editions of the program. You can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also get in touch via the Facebook and Twitter accounts at unbelievablejb or facebook.com/unbelievablejb to follow us on Facebook. And of course, all those links and more, plus today's programme and more resources from the website of Unbelievable. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Bill, let's begin as we unpack this topic by getting you to kind of give briefly at least what this argument is as it provides evidence for God in your view. Can you give us a basic rundown on the argument from the applicability of mathematics?
Well, in a sense, it is a sort of version of the fine-tuning argument that Daniel mentioned, except it's not fine-tuning of physical constants and quantities, but the mathematical nature of the physical world. It's extraordinary that the physical world embodies or instantiates this incredibly complex mathematical structure that it didn't have to exhibit. And so one wonders, well, what is the explanation of this? And the difficulty here is that if you're, say, a realist and you believe there are mathematical objects like numbers and sets and so forth, these things are typically regarded as existing beyond time and space and being causally effete. That is to say, they have no causal powers. The number seven, for example, doesn't cause anything. So it's not as though the mathematical realm could have some sort of impact upon the physical world to structure it in accord with mathematics. And if you take an anti-realist view, that is to say you think that these mathematical objects don't really exist, they're just useful fictions, like ideal points at infinity or frictionless planes or ideal gases and liquids that are used in scientific theories. These are just useful fictions. Well, then, again, it becomes mysterious how then the world would be structured according to these fictions. Why would the world have the mathematical nature that it does?
Can I
and
just
here's
quickly
where the argument for theism then comes in.
Can I just quickly, before we get to that,
yes,
Bill,
go ahead.
Just so when it comes to this realist and anti-realist view of maths,
yeah,
that the realist, as it were, believes that there is, if you like, out there objectively this realm of things that exist, but they're non-causal. They're sort of they just exist, and we can't say that much more about them. The anti
That's precisely right.
Yeah.
These are mind independent objects. They are just as real as electrons and neutrons and protons. They're independent of us.
Uh-huh.
They were there before we got here. And
that kind of comes down from Plato at some level, doesn't it, a little bit?
This is a Platonic view.
Yeah.
And so realism sometimes goes by the name Platonism.
Yes. And then the anti-realist view then essentially sees these objects, the mathematical realm, as being something we've thought up and kind of laid on the universe, but it's not actually out there as such.
Right, that's exactly right.
And so in that sense, if you're a realist, when we do maths or come up with hypotheses and so on, we're kind of discovering what's already out there at that level.
Yes, and that raises other questions in the philosophy of mathematics, namely how we could have access to this realm so as to know what it's like. But that's a different question than the question of applicability.
So, but whether we're realist or anti-realist about this mathematical realm, how does this all tie in, as far as you're concerned, to evidence for God?
Well, just this. Whether you're a realist or an anti-realist, as I've explained, the applicability of mathematics to the world seems to be, in the words of the philosopher of mathematics, Mary Lang, a happy coincidence. There isn't any sort of explanation for it. But if you're a theist, then you can believe that God has built the physical world on the mathematical structure that he had in mind. And you can say that whether you're a realist or an anti-realist. If you are a realist like Plato, then you can say that God looked to these abstract objects as his pattern and then built the world on the pattern of these abstract objects. And Plato, in fact, did believe something like that, as he says in his dialogue, the Timaeus. On the other hand, if you think these abstract objects are just fictional, that they're just made up in your mind, well, then you could hold that God has these ideas, he conceives these things, and then built the world according to that blueprint that he had in mind. And this was the view of the ancient Jewish philosopher Philo of Alexandria, who thought that the Platonic realm of ideas really were thoughts in the divine mind, and God has then built the world on that structure. So whether you're a realist or an anti-realist, if you're a theist, if you believe in God, you have the explanatory resources to explain what otherwise seems to be a complete mystery, namely the applicability of mathematics to the physical world.
And if you're a naturalist, an atheist, you simply have to, at some level, say it's a mystery or it's a very, very lucky coincidence.
It seems to me that that's correct. Yes, I haven't seen any sort of explanation.
And in your view, the theistic explanation, God, is a better explanation than simply saying, you know, we don't know or it's a happy coincidence.
Right, because the structure of the math or the mathematical structure of the physical world is so complex, it is so arcane that it just cries out for some sort of explanation rather than just saying, well, that's just the way it happened to be.
Well, that's a great introduction to the way that this argument sort of comes together, Bill, and so we're going to get a response now from Daniel on that. You've heard the argument, you've looked into it yourself, I know. What's your primary response to this? It does seem like an interesting one, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is that I entirely agree with Bill that there is a puzzle here with respect to, you know, the way in which matter or the physical universe seems to comply to the rules of maths. That is, you know, the fact that mathematical concepts adequately describe and predict the law-governed behavior of physical phenomena. And particularly striking, here are cases where the math seems to be playing a crucial role in making predictions. So, for example, you know, it's on the basis of equations alone that Maxwell was able to predict the existence of electromagnetic radiation. So the mystery here is not just the, you know, the extraordinary appropriateness of maths for the formulation of physical theories. It's also the role that mathematics plays in the very discovery of those theories. But I take it that, you know, some applications of mathematics are going to be unsurprising. So, for example, if I have one apple in one hand and another apple in my other hand, I take it that no one's going to be surprised that I've got two apples. And this is obviously just an application of 1 plus 1 equals 2. So, you know, here we've got a mathematical truth that applies to the physical world, and I don't, you know, nobody feels that this needs explaining. So I suppose, you know, the problem is supposed to arise in relation to a particular kind of higher level mathematics, where the applicability of mathematics to the physical world starts to look mysterious when you start introducing mathematical concepts that have very little or no direct physical meaning or no obvious physical interpretation. So things like negative numbers, imaginary numbers like the square root of minus one, n-dimensional spaces. So, you know, we seem to live in a three-dimensional world, but there are mathematical models that are four-dimensional, five-dimensional, even 11-dimensional. And when the number of dimensions is unspecified, it's just generalized simply as n-dimensional. Now, with the introduction of concepts like these, mathematics seems to move entirely beyond concepts that are suggested by experience. So there's nothing in our experience of the physical world that, you know, corresponds to the concept of n-dimensional space or to the square root of minus one. So these mathematical concepts don't apply to anything in the concrete world. What's puzzling, then, is that often these concepts, you know, concepts that have no obvious or natural physical interpretation, nevertheless end up playing a very fundamental role in physics.
So what's your explanation, then, I guess, as an atheist, as a skeptical agnostic? Do you go down the route of happy coincidence, or is there more to it than that?
Well, I mean, my question, first of all, would be, you know, when Eugene Wigner, in his original paper, claimed that there's no rational explanation for the efficacy of mathematics for explaining facts about the empirical world, I mean, I'm wondering whether Bill's argument is an inference to the best explanation. So is he positing God as the best explanation for the applicability of mathematics? So, you know, is he saying that theism is more explanatorily robust with respect to the effectiveness of mathematics, more robust than any of the competing naturalistic hypotheses, because there are naturalistic hypotheses which purport to explain the applicability of mathematics, or is Bill making the stronger claim that there could, in principle, be no adequate naturalistic explanation for the effectiveness of maths?
Well, let's ask Bill that directly. Bill, what's your view on that?
I don't have a hard and fast view. The way I've presented it, I think, is as an inference to the best explanation. And for listeners who aren't familiar with that terminology, the idea there is that the natural scientist, for example, is confronted with a body of data that needs to be explained. And he will then construct a pool of live options for explaining this data. And in inferring to the best explanation, he will pick that hypothesis from the pool of live options, which provides the best explanation of the data to be explained. And it does seem to me that theism would compete very favorably with any other explanation of the applicability of mathematics to the physical world. So I have framed it as an inference to the best explanation.
Hmm. Yeah, Daniel.
Okay, so, I mean, the question that then would arise, I suppose, is whether God really presents us with a good explanation, and there we would need to think about what constitutes a good explanation. What counts as a good explanation is a bone of contention in science and in the philosophy of science, but a good explanation is usually supposed to be one that can be precisely specified, one which identifies an underlying mechanism which would account for the phenomenon for which we're seeking an explanation. One criticism then of positing God as an explanation would be that it doesn't seem to specify an account of the underlying mechanism that's supposed to be at work here.
Is your worry that it's a bit of a catch-all explanation, God, in that sense?
Well, that it doesn't have some of the virtues that we would look for in a successful explanation. So To posit God as the explanation of the effectiveness of mathematics arguably lacks empirical content. So a good explanation would be an informative one, but positing God as the explanation of the effectiveness of maths is in effect just to say that, you know, an intelligent agent did something at some time, somewhere, somehow, to bring about the effectiveness of maths. Now, that's not terribly informative. It doesn't tell us how the universe came to be amenable to description in mathematical terms.
Just a quick response to that then, Bill, before we have to go to our first break.
I think that the most important criterion for assessing what makes a good explanation would be explanatory power. And it does seem to me that theism has tremendous explanatory power with respect to the applicability of mathematics, because it postulates a mind as the creator of the physical universe, who is free to create the physical universe having the structure that he has chosen. So that seems to me to be a very powerful explanation, even if it's a non-empirical one.
I guess the problem we're getting is that at this point, you can't, as it were, explain the mathematical realm with mathematics, because it's sort of, that's what it is. We're coming to, inevitably, metaphysical kind of a point at that point, aren't we, Bill? Is that the case?
Yes, this is a metaphysical explanation. It's not an empirical explanation, but it would be something that is beyond the physical in order to explain why the physical world is as it is. And I think as long as we're open to theism, that this is something that deserves to be taken seriously.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back to this and allow Daniel to respond as well. I want to kind of open up this whole area, though, of this remarkable universe we live in, which seems so open to being described and modelled in mathematical terms. Does that mean that there are this mathematical realm out there, and is God responsible for it? Those are the kinds of questions we're asking on Unbelievable today. Two very special guests join me today as we ask whether the effectiveness of mathematics provides evidence for God. William Lane Craig, known as Bill to many, joins us on the programme. Dr. Daniel Kame, philosophy lecturer at the University of Hull, my other guest today. And looking forward to your responses to today's programme as well. We'll be back here on the show that aims to get you thinking in just a moment.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories. Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
In the latest edition, we give you 10 ways to grow your church in 2015 as we distill wisdom from leaders whose congregations are bursting at the seams. There's practical advice on how to get into scripture from John Pritchard. Plus, emerging church leader Brian McLaren and evangelical Andrew Wilson debate how Jesus read the Bible. All that plus news, reviews and your favourite columnists.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample. You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's programme. A really unusual and, I think, interesting argument for the existence of God is under discussion today on Unbelievable. If you want to get in touch with the programme, by the way, do email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Let me know what you think about today's topic. We have a number of Christians and atheists who listen to the programme, and I know these kinds of programmes always generate a great response. So today on the programme, William Lane Craig joins me. He's a noted Christian philosopher, heads up the ministry Reasonable Faith as well. Dr. Daniel Kame is a philosophy lecturer at the University of Hull. He's a sceptical agnostic, but's been very appreciative of Bill's contribution to the philosophy of religion, and says that, you know, he's willing to sort of certainly think through and argue with the arguments that Bill makes. And we've been hearing that already in the course of what we've been hearing. So we're talking about the uncanny effectiveness, effectively, of mathematics. And just to give a quote in full from Eugene Wigner, who was the physicist who first wrote this paper on the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. He says, "The miracle of the appropriateness of the language of mathematics for the formulation of the laws of physics is a wonderful gift which we neither understand nor deserve. We should be grateful for it and hope that it will remain valid in future research and that it will extend, for better or for worse, to our pleasure, even though perhaps also to our bafflement, to wider branches of learning." I mean, in that sense, Bill, do you think that, I think that was probably written in the 60s, that paper originally. Do you think that still holds today with many physicists, that they continue to see this extraordinary mapping of these theories?
Oh, yes, that is quite clear. As I say, in my reading of the literature over the last several years, this question just keeps coming up again and again. And people continue to express bafflement at it. It isn't as though there is some sort of competing explanation out there that is offered. It tends to just be re-expressions of the amazement that Wigner described. So this, along with the question of the indispensability of mathematics to doing science, are two of the most important and related questions in the philosophy of mathematics. Why is mathematics indispensable for science, and why is the physical world amenable to mathematical application? So I think it does continue to be mysterious.
I remember you used this argument possibly for the first time in a debate against Alex Rosenberg at Purdue University. As I remember it, his response was something along the lines of, well, there may be many more mathematical ideas out there than we know at this present time, and so it's crazy to suggest that God is somehow responsible for it. What was your
response? His response to the argument was very weak. What he said is that the question of the applicability of mathematics pales by comparison to other questions in the philosophy of mathematics, such as how can we have cognitive access to the mathematical realm if it's really beyond space and time and causally impotent. Well, you can't solve one problem by saying there are more difficult problems. That doesn't do anything to answer the question of the applicability of mathematics. Sure. And yet that was really all he had to offer.
Do you have anything to offer on this, Daniel? Do you want to, I don't know, before we come back to the question of whether God is a good explanation, would you, you know, opt to field any explanations for why there is this effectiveness of mathematics as we see it?
I mean, if you're looking for a naturalistic explanation for the effectiveness of mathematics, I mean, one possibility is that there's a naturalistic psychological explanation for the appearance that maths is so unreasonably effective. So one possibility is that, in fact, Wigner's original argument is really quite a poor one, and it's based entirely on a kind of selection effect. That's to say, he kind of cherry-picks examples where the mathematic does seem miraculously or mysteriously to work out, as with quantum mechanics, for example, and simply ignores the nearly infinite space of physical and other phenomena that don't actually lend themselves to easy description in simple mathematical terms. I mean, another possibility is that we, when we're doing science, we select what we regard as the scientifically interesting aspects of reality, precisely in virtue of their ability to be treated mathematically. So, you know, certain phenomena are amenable to mathematical description, and they attract rich mathematical theories. And so, you know, science evolves towards areas where maths can be successfully applied.
In that sense, it puts the focus on us as beings that evidently the way we function works with mathematics, and so we tend to put mathematical explanations onto things. Is that
The idea would be that it's the selection of topics that creates the impression of mathematics' unreasonable effectiveness. So, you know, the fact is most areas of human inquiry are not mathematical, because the vast majority of the phenomena of human experience aren't amenable to mathematical description. So morality, art, aesthetics, literature, psychology, human relationships, economics, politics, international relations, none of these phenomena are amenable to mathematical description. So mathematics actually has, you know, quite significant limits to its power. Now, of course, if that kind of selection effect is at work here, that wouldn't be enough to explain, of course, why maths applies to the extent that it does. So you'd still be left with the question as to why maths applies at all. But it might go some way towards undermining the claim that mathematics is unreasonably effective.
You know,
if the applicability of maths is recognized as actually being rather limited, then those cases where it does apply might lose their aura of mystery or miraculousness. And, if you think about the number of possible questions that human beings can ask, the number that are actually tractable with science and mathematics is a vanishingly small percentage.
I'd be interested in really just letting you guys sort of chat this out a bit at this point. Bill, any responses to both those points that Daniel makes there?
Well, he makes a good point about the limited applicability of mathematics. You don't have mathematical theories of literature or politics, or sociology, or the stock market, even. So that's certainly true, but I guess to my mind that just doesn't go any distance toward resolving the problem of the fact that mathematics is applicable to the physical sciences in this extraordinary way that's so fundamental. I'm just not troubled by the fact that there aren't mathematical theories of literature or politics, but the fact that the world, the physical world, should be invested with this mathematical structure does seem to me to cry out for explanation. It's not just quantum mechanics that Daniel mentioned, but also that other twin pillar of contemporary physics, relativity theory, that is mathematical. When Einstein was struggling to formulate his general theory of relativity, he came to a blocking point where he couldn't go any farther until he went to a professional mathematician who taught him tensor calculus. And it was only after mastering tensor calculus that Einstein was then able to make advance and finally come to formulate his general theory of relativity, which is the theory of the gravitational field. So it's just so important, it's so fundamental to science and technology and that governs all of our lives that I just don't think it's can be pushed aside by saying that there aren't mathematical theories in other fields like the humanities.
But Daniel says we sort of tend to select for, as it were, the fact that we can do maths with that. So we kind of tend to select things that work along those lines. And whether there's any kind of sense in which maybe I don't know. You explain it, Daniel, because I'm probably doing a bad job of it. Any response to what Bill's saying there?
Well, I mean, just to amplify what I was trying to say before, I mean, another consideration would be that there's a large proportion of modern mathematics, such as abstract algebras, pathological functions, transfinite numbers, and so on, which have absolutely no straightforward application in the real world at all. The fact is that you know, a lot of mathematics is inapplicable. Now, if you're taking note of that as well, of the reduced level of the effectiveness of maths, might remove the appearance of the miraculous. I mean, we're also perhaps prone to forget the many failed predictions. You know, often forgetting failed predictions makes success when you achieve it seem more surprising. So, you know, if you're thinking about this, a phenomenon which is familiar to all of us, is you're thinking about a friend, and all of a sudden the telephone rings and it's your friend. And you find this to be a remarkable coincidence. What makes it seem remarkable is that you're forgetting the multitude of occasions when you've been thinking about your friend and the phone hasn't rung.
Sure.
So, analogously, in the case of applied mathematics, it could be our forgetfulness of its many failures. That is, you know, how much trial and error is actually involved in finding the right mathematical model for a given natural phenomenon that creates the impression of unreasonable effectiveness. I mean, to make an assessment of how unreasonable the effectiveness of maths really is, we'd need to know, you know, how many cases of mathematical concepts devised for purely mathematical purposes are never successfully applied, and we need to know how many predictions in physics based on pure mathematics turn out to be accurate. I mean, perhaps it's the case that the number of unsuccessful mathematical models, that is, models that fail to apply, are far more numerous than the successful ones.
Okay.
If that were the case, then the applicability of maths wouldn't be at all surprising. Rather, you know, just like with any sufficiently large sample, any outrageous thing is going to happen.
Bill?
To say that the physical world instantiates a mathematical structure isn't to say that there are not alternative mathematical structures that it could have instantiated instead. I think that is, in fact, part of the mystery of that it requires explanation. I mentioned the general theory of relativity. Well, you can have, as is well known, various space-time geometries. On a simplest level, you could have a Euclidean geometry where space-time is flat, like a plane. Or you could have a spherical or curved geometry, like the surface of a sphere. Or you could have a saddle-shaped sort of geometry. And these will have different implications in different structures. And to say that the world instantiates one of these mathematical structures is not to say that there aren't other possibilities. That's part of the, I think, the mystery of why is it that the world does have the mathematical structure that it does. And again, the theist here would say that God is quite free to give the world the mathematical structure that he chooses it to have. He can build it on the mathematical model he has in mind. So he could have made a world with a Euclidean geometry, or he could have made one with a spherical geometry. But in any case, it's extraordinary, I think, that the world does exhibit this sort of mathematical structure. It didn't have to have it.
Well, would you not say, though, that having a physical reality describable by some sort of mathematics would apply for any consistently operating physical reality. So, I mean, we can imagine possible worlds in which the laws of nature are very different. And so you can imagine a possible world, for example, in which the inverse square law is just the square law, or it's the inverse cubed law. I mean, maths would still be able to describe this. So maths would still apply, because maths is necessary, and so is the same across all possible worlds. So we can imagine a possible world in which the laws of nature are very different, but nevertheless, maths is going to apply. So as long as you have a physical system which is consistent, then some kind of mathematics is going to apply, surely. I mean, unless you have a completely chaotic universe, then I think it's going to be unsurprising that some sort of mathematics is going to apply to it.
Well, I think that is true with regard to what you said earlier, Daniel, about low-level mathematics. For example, the truths of elementary arithmetic are things that would be logically necessary and would apply in any possible world. Or I was recently reading a book by one mathematical realist who gives the example of the mathematician Euler and his proof that the bridges in Königsberg in Prussia could not all be traversed by only crossing each one time. You would have to go over one of the bridges twice in order to traverse all the bridges. And the author was pointing out this is a mathematical necessity. Everyone in Königsberg was aware of this truth, but Euler provided a mathematical proof of this. Well, now, these kinds of mathematical truths or structures wouldn't be mysterious because they're metaphysically necessary. But as Daniel says, when you get into higher level mathematics, like my example of different geometries, for example, or general theory of relativity or quantum mechanics, there isn't any sort of metaphysical necessity that the world has to exhibit these sort of structures. And so again, the naturalist, it seems to me, is just sort of left saying that this is a happy coincidence, which really isn't explanatory at all.
Yeah, do you want to come back on that, Daniel? I mean, is what you're saying, Daniel, that even at the higher level types of, you know, mathematics and the physics it describes and so on, that, well, you could still have another possible world in which there might be a different set of physics and would be existent, but we would come up with a maths that would describe that, if you like. Is that what I'm getting from you?
Well, yes. I mean, standardly, mathematical truths are taken to be necessary truths, and one way of expressing that is to say that they are true in all possible worlds. So in all possible worlds, 2 plus 3 equals 5.
Mm-hmm.
Laws of nature, by contrast, are plausibly contingent. That's to say that they vary across possible worlds. So we can imagine worlds in which the laws of nature are radically different from the way they are in the actual world. Now, I mean, even if the laws of nature are different in other possible worlds, arguably maths is still going to apply. So, you know, the example I used before was the inverse square law. If you have a world in which the inverse square law is actually the inverse cubed law, well, there's no reason why maths is not going to be able to describe that. Because it seems that for any physical reality that's describable by some sort of mathematics, it's going to be the case that any physical reality is describable by some sort of mathematics if that physical reality is consistently operating in some way. Because maths applies in all possible worlds, the effectiveness of maths is in effect unsurprising.
Okay. Bill, so I'm you'll have to help me here because I may be struggling to keep up, but the effectiveness of mathematics is unsurprising if mathematics holds in all possible worlds, I think is where Daniel's coming from here. So what's your response on that?
I guess the question here would be, is must the physical world, by metaphysical necessity, exhibit the sort of structure that it has? And I think we both recognize that no, it doesn't. It's contingent that the mathematical world, or rather that the physical world, would instantiate the particular mathematical structure that it does. And so I'm wanting to say, what's the explanation of that? And I think Daniel seems content to simply say, well, it's just as good as any other, and so there just isn't really anything here to be explained.
Is that the case, Daniel?
Well, I mean, I'd want to come back to the question of whether God provides an adequate explanation. I mean, if we accept the claim that the effectiveness of maths really is surprising, then the question arises as to whether positing God constitutes an adequate explanation for the phenomenon.
Mm.
I mean, one thing you look for in a good explanation is testability or specific predictions, so that you can go out and see whether those predictions are true or false. So the question would be, well, are there any specific predictions that come out of positing God as an explanation for the effectiveness of maths? Well, I don't think there are. I mean, because God is omnipotent, he can do anything, and because he's also mysterious and his purposes are unfathomable and so on, literally any observed state of affairs is consistent with the hypothesis. I mean, he's omnipotent, so there's nothing he can't do, so the range of possible actions that he might perform or changes in the material world that he might affect aren't constrained by what he's capable of doing. But nor can we say that the range of possible actions that he might perform or events that he would allow to occur is constrained by his nature, because his nature is unfathomable. So even if we say that his nature is not unfathomable, and that we know, for example, that he's morally perfect or all-loving and so will only allow things to happen that are good for us, well, that's still compatible with just about any observed state of affairs, because it will always be possible to say that he allowed this instance of, apparently gratuitous suffering for reasons that are inaccessible to us.
We'll come back to that as well. But okay, Bill, so God as an explanation, we've come back to this, and we find this popping up, I think, a lot of the time in other areas of philosophy, of religion and science as well. But is God just, as we say, a catch-all, a God of the gaps, or something like that, where we're not really dealing with an explanation? It's too vague at some level, says Daniel.
Yeah, I don't think that's the case. Now, it's true, I can't think of any sort of predictions that one might make, but this isn't being offered as an empirical hypothesis. This is a metaphysical explanation. This is an exercise in metaphysical reasoning to try to find a good explanation for why the physical world has the mathematical structure that it does. And here it seems to me that the inference is one that we're very familiar with in everyday experience. Namely, we understand products that are the result of human intelligent design and execution. I mentioned Philo of Alexandria earlier, who argued for this with respect to God's creation of the physical world. He gives the example of an architect building a city. He plans it out in his mind first, draws up his blueprints, and then he directs those who build the city to construct it according to what the architect had in mind. This is a familiar sort of activity that we're all acquainted with. And so with respect to the universe, unless you're just closed to theism, which is a different issue, it seems to me that this is a very familiar sort of explanation that we should be open to.
I mean, essentially, it's an inference to a designer. We make that inference.
Well, that's why I said it's really sort of an instance of the fine-tuning argument.
Sure, yeah.
It's the fine-tuning of the physical world on this mathematical structure. And so it is a sort of design argument. It's an argument for an intelligent mind behind the cosmos.
Sure. Daniel, I mean, you're familiar, obviously, with this idea of the argument from design and so on, which if you like, this argument is a form of. I mean, Bill says, but this is a metaphysical explanation, ultimately, so it's not open to the kind of empirical results type of explanation that you're looking for, because in the end, at one level, it's hard to see how you would get that for mathematics, which is so fundamental to the structure of the universe. At one level, it's hard to say how you would give an explanation that is testable, repeatable, and all those other things we like in empirical sciences.
Well, okay, so I take Bill's point about metaphysical explanation not necessarily being subject to the same kinds of requirements as ordinary empirical explanations. So the idea is that metaphysical explanations shouldn't expect metaphysical explanations to issue in empirical predictions. And I'm not sure exactly why that's supposed to be the case, why we shouldn't expect metaphysical facts to have empirical consequences or effects. But I mean, surely it's got to be the case that a metaphysical explanation must be consistent with what else we know, with our background knowledge. I mean, that would be another hallmark of a good explanation, that it's consistent with our background knowledge, that is, with what else we already know. So, I mean, a question that I would want to ask then is, well, is theism consistent with our background knowledge? Well, as far as we know, affecting changes in the physical universe requires having a body. So, you know, seeking to explain the mathematical structure of the physical world in terms of the creative designs of an unembodied mind is, you know, arguably inconsistent with this piece of background knowledge. I mean, indeed, the very idea of an unembodied mind is arguably inconsistent with our background knowledge that having a mind requires having a brain. I mean, I wouldn't want to completely rule out the possibility that some form of substance dualism is true. So human beings are a composite of a physical and a non-physical component, our minds or consciousness being non-physical. I wouldn't want to rule out the possibility that that's true, because we really have, you know, very little understanding of what the relationship is between consciousness and the brain. But one's inclined to say that it seems obvious that consciousness depends on the brain. You know, using brain scanning, we can obtain one-to-one mapping of states of consciousness and states of the brain, or we can find correlations between states of consciousness and states of the brain. And of course, we don't really know anything about the relationship between consciousness and the brain from the existence of these correlations, but it certainly looks like there is a very close empirical dependency of states of consciousness on states of the brain. So in other words, it looks like to have states of consciousness, you've got to have a brain.
Well let's get a quick response from Bill before we have to go to another break and start to wrap things up.
Well, I would say just very quickly that isn't an objection to the argument from the applicability of mathematics. That's an objection to theism, period. And of course, if you're not open to theism, then this isn't going to be an acceptable explanation to a person. So this question throws the debate into a quite wider arena that isn't really about this argument in particular, but about the coherence of theism, period.
Sure. In that sense, I mean, Daniel, are you, if we took, say, God out of it and just talked about design, would you be kind of happier to say, yes, design seems to be a valid explanation for the effectiveness of mathematics?
Well, I suppose one issue I would have with the argument as Bill has presented it in the past is that the conclusion of the argument is that God exists. Now, the effectiveness of maths, I don't think, gives us any particular reason to suppose that there exists a benevolent God or a God who has any interest in human beings at all. And the hypothesis that there exists a benevolent creator, you know, given the data, the existence of tsunamis and child cancer and gas chambers and things like that, it looks spectacularly unlikely. So I think, you know, the conclusion God exists, if by God we mean the Christian God or the God of traditional monotheism, then I don't think the conclusion follows at all. So
okay.
I think at the very least, the argument seems to support a very minimal conception of God as a designer, not the God of traditional monotheism.
Just a quick response, Bill, and then we'll go to a break.
Well, I'd agree that it is part of a cumulative case for theism, and it doesn't say anything about the moral qualities of this cosmic mind. So that's true, but again, that is not an objection to this argument. That throws the debate into a much wider arena where we talk about the problem of evil, talk about mind-body dualism and things of that sort, and those are yeah. different issues.
And in a sense, that's true of many arguments, the argument from fine-tuning and others that you could, the ontological argument, they don't obviously get you to the Trinitarian full-blooded Christian God, but they do, as it were, provide evidence, as far as you're concerned, Bill, for for a creator at the very least, and the concept of a
God. Yeah, this would give us evidence for an incredibly intelligent, if not omniscient, mind that is enormously powerful behind the cosmos, a sort of creator and designer of the cosmos of incomprehensible intelligence and power.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back in just a moment's time to finish up this conversation. We're talking about the uncanny effectiveness of mathematics. Does it provide evidence for God? My guests today on the program, William Lane Craig and Daniel Kame. Welcome back to the final part of today's Unbelievable. It's brought to you as part of Faith Explored, which is brought to you in association with Premier Christianity Magazine. That's the magazine that I'm the senior editor of. And if you'd like a free sample copy, then why not go to the website and simply ask for one at premierchristianity.com/free sample. We've also put a blog up there on the Premier Christianity site in response to these recent tragic events in Paris this last week. And we've actually opted to invite an imam to give his reflection on that as well. So so if you want to see that, simply go to the website premierchristianity.com. Later on in today's show, you can actually hear some response to last week's programme and what a lot of response we've had to the nature of hell. Is it a place of annihilation or eternal torment? And representing the traditional eternal torment view was a well-known theologian and Baptist leader, Al Mohler, and he was in conversation with Chris Date of Rethinking Hell. Well, you'll hear some of the responses to that a little while later. Can I encourage you as well, if you're based in London or you're in striking distance of the capital, then why not get along to the Reasons for God event on Saturday, the 24th of January? It's in just a couple of weeks' time. Have you ever struggled with the big questions, been baffled by friends or colleagues' objections to the Christian faith? Well, it's put on by RZIM, some fabulous speakers. Vince Vitale, Tom Price, Tanya Walker, Simon Edwards and Becky Manley Pippert will be there in London for this day conference. Tickets just £15 and even less if you're a student or unwaged. And you can book online at www.rzim.eu. So that's Saturday 24th of January at St Mary's Church, Bryanston Square, Wyndham Place, York Street, London, from 9:30 to 4:30. It's going to include talks on five reasons for God, such as designing the universe, thinking about reason, God and morality, history and Jesus, personal experience, and I'm sure it'll be a great place to connect with unbelievable listeners, many of whom I know will be going along to that event. So www.rzim.eu. We want to throw our weight behind those guys, great friends of Unbelievable, the folks from RZIM, and indeed Vince Vitale is coming on a show in the not too distant future to talk about suffering. He's got a new book out with Ravi Zacharias on that, and he's going to be in conversation with atheist philosopher Julian Baggini. So another one to look forward to in the future weeks here on Unbelievable. A little less in advance, next week on Unbelievable, we're going to be hearing the first of two conversations between David Marshall and John Loftus. John Loftus is well known on the internet as a former Christian who became an atheist and now runs an anti-Christian sort of debunking type website. And he's got a reasonably well-known approach to this called the outsider test of faith, which he believes kind of puts the nail in the coffin of Christianity. Well, David Marshall is a Christian apologist who has written a book responding to that. And his book is called How Christianity Passes the Outsider Test and claims to show why Christianity is unique among world religions in four key ways. Well, we'll be hearing their discussion next week on the programme. If you can come back either here on Premier between 2:30 and 4 or online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. But first of all, let's finish up our discussion between William Lane Craig and Daniel Kame.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
It's been a really interesting discussion today on the programme as we've asked whether the applicability of mathematics provides evidence for God. Does maths plus effectiveness equal God, I suppose, is another way you could put this question. But one thing that struck me when I was just looking into this in advance of hosting today's programme, Bill, was that I've heard it said that the very, if you like, birth of modern science as we know it, to some extent owed itself to a theistic, a Christian view of the universe that expected to find law-like regularity in the universe. Is that a fair assessment? How does that play into this particular argument?
Well, I'm not a historian of science, but I know that people like Alfred North Whitehead have said and believed that modern science was birthed in the context of Western culture as opposed to the Orient or Africa because of the Christian theological commitment to the rationality of the physical world, that the physical world does exhibit this rational structure, which would include mathematics, and is therefore amenable to rational exploration and discovery. And that is part of the reason that science was born and flourished within the West.
Hmm. I mean, let's come to you, Daniel. Obviously, Bill has said in that last section that he's not saying this argument in any way gets us to the full-blooded Christian view of God, but it's part of a cumulative argument. What's your take on this then? I mean, it sounds like you're willing to almost, as you said, see some evidence here for some kind of deism. Obviously, you don't see that as getting you close to, you know, Bill's view of God fleshed out, but it sounds like, to me, you're not exactly kind of kicking and screaming against his argument. You've got some openness to it as design or some kind of mind being potentially an explanation for it.
Well, I wouldn't want to categorically rule it out. No, I mean, I fully accept that there's a very deep puzzle here. I mean, there's also a problem here to do with the role that aesthetic considerations play in the development of mathematical theories, which renders the problem even more puzzling. I mean, scientists and philosophers often invoke aesthetic considerations to help decide between two theories that are empirically equivalent. So, you know, scientists will prefer a theory that's more simple or elegant to a theory that has the same degree of empirical support but which lacks the simplicity and elegance of the rival theory. Now, you know, there's a problem here as to why there should be any kind of relationship between aesthetic considerations and the epistemic worth of a theory. Now, that's puzzling enough. But aesthetics plays an even more puzzling role in the problem of the unreasonable effectiveness of math, because in math, aesthetic considerations seem often to be responsible for the development of mathematical theories themselves. And it's these mathematical theories in turn which, you know, then play a very crucial role in the discovery of our best scientific theories. Mm. So, you know, new empirical phenomena are discovered via mathematical models which were devised to satisfy purely aesthetic desiderata. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't based on any experimental observations, for example, that Dirac was able to predict the existence of antimatter. Now, that is, these kinds of facts about the applicability of maths to the physical world do look extremely mysterious.
You use the word mysterious. I mean, obviously, very often I hear mathematicians and physicists talk about the beauty of mathematics. And in that sense, yes, it's almost an aesthetic appeal, isn't it, to the nature of these theories and the way they all map together and hold together in such a quote-unquote beautiful way. And that seems to, as you say, lend a lot of the weight behind why we believe these theories and we invest so much in them. You say they're mysterious in that sense because it's somehow, does that mysteriousness point to something beyond itself, or is that just a mystery that we kind of take as a brute fact of the universe?
Well, it can be viewed at this stage as an unsolved problem. I mean, you know, I've marshalled a number of possible sort of naturalistic psychological explanations as to why things appear, why the effectiveness of mathematics appears so remarkable. I'm not suggesting that any of those psychological explanations actually fully adequately explains the effectiveness of mathematics, but I think it would be premature to rule out the possibility of a purely naturalistic or scientific explanation. There doesn't seem to me to be any, you know, in principle reason why there couldn't be a naturalistic explanation, and that one must, you know, have recourse to God in order to explain the effectiveness of maths.
Let's come to you, Bill, then, just as we start to close out the programme. We don't need to rule God in. We shouldn't rule out other possible explanations down the line. So at this point, for you, is God simply the best explanation on the table, I suppose, as we know about maths?
Honestly, Justin, I think he's the only explanation on the table. I don't see what the competing naturalistic hypotheses are. And Daniel's point about the aesthetic aspects of the physical world is a very interesting one that I hadn't even thought to draw into the discussion, but is certainly relevant here. Sometimes scientists will be very dissatisfied with a theory because they say it's too ugly to be true, and are guided by these qualities of or criteria of elegance and simplicity and so forth in the quest for the right mathematical theory. So, and in terms of naturalism, I think here it's what makes it so difficult for naturalism to give an explanation, even in principle, is that we are asking for an explanation of the entire natural realm. Why does the whole physical universe instantiate this mathematical structure? And there can't be anything about it that explains itself. So it's very difficult to see how there could be any naturalistic explanation about why nature is mathematical. You need something transcendent.
We're going to have to draw a close. Daniel, it's been really good to have you on. Anything you'd suggest to people who want to look into this for themselves? I mean, I know it's an area that because I invited you on, you started to look into in a bit more depth yourself, and where people could take it next if they're interested.
Yeah, well, I could recommend the writings of Quine and Putnam, Villard van Orman Quine and Hilary Putnam, who were two very important 20th century philosophers who wrote a lot about the supposed indispensability of mathematics for science. They support a realist view of the nature of mathematical objects. And then there was a very interesting book which was written largely in response to Quine and Putnam's indispensability thesis by a philosopher named Hartree Field, a book called Science Without Numbers, which purports to show that, in fact, mathematics isn't indispensable to science, and that scientific theories can be reformulated in terms which are completely purged of all mathematical vocabulary. And he does this with the example of Newtonian gravitational theory.
Daniel, it's been great having you on. Thank you for being on the program today.
Thank you.
It's been really interesting to get your input on today. Bill, thanks also. And when can we expect to see the fruits of all your labours when it comes to your investigations into these realms of mathematics and realist and anti-realist views of reality and so on?
Well, let me say before I answer that question that we mustn't confuse the indispensability of mathematics with its applicability, as I said. Those are two distinct issues. But I'll be in the UK in March at the University of Birmingham delivering the Cadbury Lectures on God and Abstract Objects. And so there'll be a whole week of lectures that would be open to the public if you'd like to come and hear more about God and these mathematical objects.
Fantastic. Well, we can certainly look forward to that, Bill, and hearing them, I'm sure, online once they've been recorded. But we look forward to that. In the meantime, thank you very much for coming on the programme, both gentlemen. It's been a really interesting area, one that certainly opened up a lot of interesting areas for me as a new interesting example of an area of argumentation for the evidence of God. And if you want to find out more about my guests, Daniel Kame is from the University of Hull. You can find his profile page on their website. And William Lane Craig, of course, heads up the ministry Reasonable Faith, reasonablefaith.org, for more examples and articles, blog posts, the podcast, and much more besides. Thanks, gentlemen, for a fantastic discussion, and I wish you all the very best for 2015.
Thanks very much,
Justin.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, before we get to some of your feedback, just a reminder that if you enjoyed what William Lane Craig had to say on the programme today, you can always avail yourself of the Unbelievable Conference 2014 DVD and audio CD, which features him and, of course, a number of other Christian thinkers and apologists who joined me back in July at Westminster Central Hall. To find out more, premierchristianradio.com/DVD to order yours. Perhaps treat yourself in the new year. We've got some feedback as well. We're going to be hearing about your thoughts on the debate on hell last week. But before we get to some of those, going a bit further back, Keith Ward and Michael Roos debated the evidence for God at the beginning of December. Here's what Mike in Toronto had to say. There is something truly profound talked about in the show. And though it's acknowledged, the ramifications from a philosophical and social perspective are often overlooked. Keith Ward says that he could possibly accept no afterlife because he's had a good life. But he says, what of all the people whose lives have not been so good, whose talents and aspirations haven't been fulfilled? Michael Roos acknowledged this and simply accepts the atheist reality that life isn't fair. But wait a second, really consider that idea. What would be the consequences if this worldview were to dominate? Think of all the billions of people today and throughout history born into abject poverty that live their entire lives scavenging, people who are born into slavery and are subject to harsh servitude and never receive a day of relief from their curial masters. Think of the millions in third world countries whose lives subsist in mind-numbing labour in order to maintain the prosperous economies of affluent countries, the countless men and women whose lives were dominated by war upon war. All pain and suffering throughout the ages, senseless, meaningless. So what hope does atheism bring? What arguments can be made against suicide for people in these situations? What defence can be presented against people who steal, rape and murder to try to win the good life, the only life they'll ever have? If atheist philosophers were truly wise, they should be promoting religious beliefs for no other reason than their own privileged self-preservation, says Mike. Let's go to another show that we had just before Christmas. This was whether Isaiah prophesied the virgin birth. Alistair McKitterick and Robert Stovold were in discussion about that. Here's Peter Sean Bradley from Fresno in California, who I know is a regular contributor in the Unbelievable group on Facebook. He asks, is Alistair McKitterick on the road to Rome? On the recent episode featuring the discussion on the virgin birth, several things McKitterick said seemed both familiar and surprising. First, Alistair made the interesting point that the metaphor of Zion giving birth virginally to its Messiah was made real in the actual virgin birth of Jesus by Mary. These kinds of metaphor becoming reality are the stuff of Chestertonian paradox, but I had to wonder about his take on the greatest such metaphor becoming surprisingly real, namely John 6:51, I am the living bread that came down from heaven. Whoever eats this bread will live forever. Or is that a Catholic bridge too far? Second, in the same vein, I almost fell out of my chair when McKitterick, an evangelical professor at a Bible college, observed that the typology of Mary as Zion raises the importance of Mary herself, and Mary becomes something more than a human incubator. That was a surprising concession, since all too often I find that evangelical attitudes towards Mary do go a long way in the direction of being a human incubator. And if you couldn't tell from that, Peter himself is a Catholic and was all for hearing Alistair McKitterick give what he thought were some interesting arguments in favour of the Catholic view of Mary's role. Anyway, thank you very much. Let's get on to these many emails that came in anyway on the Rethinking Hell episode. Should evangelicals be rethinking their approach to hell? We heard from someone who had rethought their approach to hell, Chris Date. He's one of the founders of the Rethinking Hell website and was able to give, I think, some really interesting arguments for the biblical view of annihilationism or conditional immortality. And in that conversation with Al Mola of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, who hell holds to a traditional eternal conscious torment view. So here's some of what you had to say about that. Ray Chung says, thanks for another great discussion. Unbelievable is just brilliant. Regarding the Rethinking Hell debate, I was surprised that neither participant mentioned what I would have thought was the most obvious verse. And the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of burning sulfur where the beast and the false prophet had been thrown. They will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Revelation 20 verse 10. I think it's almost inescapable that the false prophet is a human person or persons. Is he the only one in this this lake of fire? It would seem not. As it goes on to say, then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. The lake of fire is the second death, and so on. I don't bring this up to gloat, but as a matter of interpreting scriptures faithfully and fairly, and also as important implications of how we faithfully present the gospel. And you say you've sent that comment over to Chris as well, and at the time you emailed me, were awaiting the response. Anyway, thank you very much. Ryan from Kentucky says, I have a few perspectives and opinions I'd like to offer. It's my perception that Al Mohler appealed to tradition far too many times to be taken seriously. In my experience dealing with him on other topics, he seems highly non-intellectual, I don't mean unintelligent, preferring to preserve doctrine rather than promote truth. He used the argument that the church has a tradition of interpreting scripture one way, and therefore we should continue interpreting it that way because he perceives that as likely the obvious reading of the text to a layman. And he says Chris used fancy, complicated grammatical arguments to make his point. My question for him is, why should we trust the layman reading, the traditional reading, when scholarship has progressed so far in both textual criticism and our understanding of Christian history? But you also had a criticism for Chris Date, saying he holds to the relatively regular assumption that most evangelicals make, unsupported by scholarship, which says that the Bible represents only one theological opinion on any given topic. I would argue the Bible has many theological opinions on this topic, both in the Old and New Testament. Alf Latham in Middlewich, Cheshire, says, in the biblical text interchange between Mohler and Date, there was too little employment of elementary principles of justice. In the parable about the rich man and Lazarus, Jesus demonstrates several moral points. First, the poor man at last receives dignity and healing with Abraham. Abraham then indicates to the rich man why he's on the rubbish heap. In life, the rich man dismissed Lazarus as a nobody, allowing him to suffer hunger, thirst, heat, cold, illness, and gave him no dignity. Therefore, the rich man now suffers what he allowed the poor man to suffer. This is simply justice as retributive, measure for measure, payback. But even now, the rich man still dismisses Lazarus as a nobody in comparison to Abraham and to himself. He asks Abraham to bid Lazarus cool his tongue and for him to go back to warn his brothers. He still discounts the worth of Lazarus. Jesus is making clear that nobody is allowed into heaven with that baggage. Well, there are two possible outcomes. The positive outcome is that he finally realizes what his suffering is meant to show and in repentance sincerely apologizes at last to Lazarus, to whom he showed no pity. But if he doesn't, we're left to presume from another warnings that he is let to enter the domain of like-minded, hard-hearted, self-made man in outer darkness. Now, as to whether that therefore suggests an annihilationist or eternal conscious torment view, I'm not sure, but it's a really interesting point of view, Alf, on that particular parable told by Jesus. Chris in Brooklyn says, this week's discussion on hell was engaging as ever, but it reflected why Christians have such a hard time appealing to non-believers, myself included. Al Mohler and the traditionalists will have to come up with a rational explanation as to why a loving God would torment me for eternity for the sin of not believing in him for a relatively short 75 years or so. Chris Date and the annihilationists will have to explain to me why, since I expect non-existence to be my fate at the end of my life, I should worry about God's penalty for non-belief. And both will have to answer the really big question. On such a transcendentally important question as the eternal future of every person on earth, how is it their holy scripture is so unclear and two such divergent philosophies can be supported? Okay, loads of stuff here. Maybe just time for one more from Perry Marshall. Says, good job. 20 years ago, I met an atheist who grew up a Catholic. By far, his number one reason for rejecting faith was hell being in a place of eternal conscious torment. He found a random accidental universe far more sensible than a loving God who gratuitously tortures people forever. Well, I can affirm Chris Date's assertion that the traditional view does repel some people from the gospel. I think Chris overstated his case slightly in several places, but he did make important points. Passages in the Old Testament like Isaiah 34:10, where a city has been burned to the ground and stands as a permanent memory, lend a much different flavour to the idea of eternal destruction. Faith of the Early Fathers by Jurgens is a catalogue of early church writings from 80 AD to the Middle Ages. There you can see what I call hell inflation. Early comments about hell are much the same as scripture themselves, but by 200 AD, people are saying things like, the clever fire that burns the limbs and restores them, wears them away and yet sustains them. Later authors elaborate on that idea so that by the Middle Ages you have Dante's lurid descriptions of people being tossed back and forth between ice and fire. Many biblical passages do imply death, not unending torture. What traditionists call eternal destruction would actually seem to be something more like eternal non-destruction. I question whether they're capturing the idea correctly. Church consensus does side with Al Mohler's view, and I can't honestly dismiss it, but it does seem that the exact nature of final judgment in the Bible has much ambiguity. Perhaps this should not surprise us. Does God punish people infinitely for a finite life of sin, even though Jesus was able to pay for all the wrongs of humanity in a single day? That never quite made sense to me. A useful metaphor for eternal destruction might be radioactive decay, where technically it never ends, but does have a half-life and reduces exponentially over time. The duration is infinite, but the quantity of uranium converted to lead is finite. I personally remain undecided on this issue. Ultimately, I refer to the nature of God as revealed in Scripture, that he is absolutely just and fair and does not take pleasure in the destruction of the wicked, Ezekiel 33. And there are lots of useful comments in the Facebook thread, by the way. Thank you, Perry. Yes, lots of conversation when I posted this to the Unbelievable Facebook page. So if you want to visit that, it's facebook.com/unbelievablejb. And equally, under the programme, where if you go to the actual Unbelievable episode at the website, you can find lots of comments there from people. I'm just going to maybe bring a couple of those as well. So that's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Go to the episode in question. You'll find a lot of conversations going on. Here's what Gary said. I was a little disappointed your guest spent the whole time talking about whether the Bible verses support their view, and none talking about whether their view makes sense. Eternal conscious punishment seems to me the very definition of pointless suffering. Supposedly, once the resurrection occurs, everyone will be either in heaven or hell for eternity. So what's the point in continuing to punish people in hell? It wouldn't serve as a deterrent for misbehavior, nor would it change the way the damned behave or believe. If nothing good would ever come for it, then I fail to see how it would make any sense. If that were the actual state of affairs, then the only compassionate thing to do would be to put them out of their misery. On the other hand, Ricardo says, I'm glad the Southern Baptists are actively fighting this trash. Annihilationism has a horrible stench. As Christians, we believe in the Scripture, which quite clearly depicts eternal conscious torment. There you go. Just a variety of comments coming in. Thanks to everyone who's been in touch about it. Well, that brings us to the end of today's programme, and thank you for joining me. And come again for another exciting hour of debate at the same time next week. I'll tell you what's coming up now. You're unbelievable. David Marshall is a Christian apologist. His new book, How Christianity Passes the Outsider Test, is a rebuttal of well-known internet atheist John Loftus. They both join me on the programme next week to debate that and the validity of the Christian faith in a world of many different religions. Join me for that same time, same place next week here on the show that aims to get you thinking. Unbelievable. Joining me next for The Profile, Pete Gregg.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.